devastating effect of cold snaps and hurricanes on our fruits and vegetables in the fields? Entire orange groves wiped out? Or entire grape crops dying due to the lack of water and a drought? Or wiped out by the horrible wildfires in Northern California? The Washington Post and the journal Nature Climate Change reported in December of 2019 that, quote, extreme weather patterns are raising the risk of a global food crisis. Climate change will make this worse, close quote. Yikes, folks. They described multiple crop failures around the world at once, including in soybeans, corn, wheat, and others due to many and many more severe weather events in what's called the breadbasket of the world, including in the United States. So what do we do about it? What if more of our lettuce and apples and corn, etc., were grown indoors like a giant greenhouse? Well, today we're going to find out from a woman who's been working in climate issues for about 25 years and is now doing this kind of work. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility, energy, and sustainability-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, on greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you are struggling with your own career, especially in this crisis, please reach out to us and let us know via Twitter or our Contact Us page on our website or LinkedIn. We can help you no matter what industry you're in. Okay, so we've all seen greenhouses. I interviewed Donnie Nolan, for example, who runs the greenhouse at George Mason University in Virginia, about how her facility is providing food and even spices to the university's food service. And we see greenhouses with just flowers, like at Hillwood Estates and other properties. And now we see cannabis plants being grown in greenhouses. But what about greenhouses on a commercial scale? And ones that recycle water or do not use toxic fertilizers or get more out of the acreage than tenting an outdoor farm would, right? Well, that's what my guest today says their novel indoor farm will actually do. So let's find out how it works. I'd like you to meet Jackie Roberts, Chief Sustainability Officer at AppHarvest. Jackie has been in the sustainability space, as I said, for probably 25 years, including in the same role, Chief Sustainability Officer at the Carlyle Group, which is an investment company, and as Senior Director of the Environmental Defense Fund, or EDF, where I first met her probably about 10 years ago, I think it was, right? She earned all her degrees from Yale, smart cookie that she is, including a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering and two, count them, master's degrees, one from the Yale School of Management and the other from the School of the Environment. Without further ado, welcome to Green Connections Radio, Jackie, and thank you for joining us. I'm so excited.
Thank you, Joan. It's great to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Congratulations on your new role at AppHarvest. Give us an overview of the indoor farms. How does AppHarvest actually work? Where are they, you know, where is it located? I understand it's in Appalachia, but give us a little more details, you know, kind of what you're growing. Give us the proverbial 30,000 foot view.
AppHarvest, I think, is a really unique company in that our core product, which is healthy vegetables, is combined with a very sustainable, climate resilient way of growing those vegetables. And we're doing it in Appalachia, where the opportunity for job growth and economic development is really appreciated. The core product is a chemical pesticide free, in our first large greenhouse, which you can see a picture of in my background, but it's 60 acres for those who can't see it, is growing tomatoes. And it's chemical pesticide free and GMO free because the way we can grow in a closed system enables us to use biological pest approaches to control pests and disease, and also a lot of trained workers and other interventions that can prevent outbreaks. So we, you know, as a mother with three children, knowing that what's coming out of our greenhouses is, you know, zero residue is a real attribute that I value. But how we grow it is what your introduction spoke to. We are very climate resilient. In the storms, the ice storms that have recently hit, you know, we had some employees that had trouble getting to work. Other people had to pitch in. We had one employee show up on their tractor to make sure they could get to work. But, you know, we really did incredibly well in terms of being resilient. We had all the things we needed. We were harvesting on time. Stuff was getting out to the markets. And it was a real testament to this strategy as an important part of the mix of different types of agriculture. And when we're growing, we are able to use 100% rainwater. We have a system of irrigation that is set up where the rainwater is captured on the top of our 60-acre roofs. It's stored in a retention pond, and then we bring it into the greenhouse with a little bit of filtration through sand and UV light. And that water recirculates. We don't ever release anything into the atmosphere. The nutrients are put into the water and stay in the water until we need to add more. We can measure very precisely. It's a space where AI has really enabled us to do very precise measurements and give the plants exactly what they need. We do some nanotechnology with bubbling the water because bringing more oxygen into the water enables the plants to absorb the nutrients even better. But all of that is a closed system. And you know, when I started in chemical engineering, the reason I went into chemical engineering is I had a wonderful professor who said, if you care about environmental problems, you should study chemical engineering because you learn how a system works and where all the pollution comes from and how it's released to the environment. Well, now I have a closed system that I'm getting to work on every day, and it can do amazing things.
So that's great. There's a lot to unpack in there. So first of all, GMO is one of those funny things. I mean, I actually have a bit of a controversial view on this because I think if you can feed more of the world with rice that has been modified to be higher in protein and those people stay healthier, then that's a good thing. So in my head, all GMO food, modified, all genetically modified food is not created equal. It's not the boogeyman to me all the time. I know a lot of people are like, ah! You know, but I think there are times when it can actually be a really good thing because it can increase the nutrients for people who need them.
And we've seen another example where some breeding has enabled communities in Africa to grow seeds that are more climate resilient to drought and other areas. We would simply look at the feedback from consumers, that consumers are drawn to non-GMO products. We know that, we hear that, we see that, and that's how we look at the issue, and that's why we want to make sure consumers know that that's one of our attributes.
I appreciate that. So you mentioned several things, but what I wanted to drill down, one of the few I wanted to drill down on, is how the rainwater system works, because you said that, so like it rains. I mean, I'm in Virginia also, and it rains a certain amount, but it's not like Hawaii, right? How does that actually work? I mean, the rain, but that you can't only depend on rainwater. I mean, there's not enough of it.
Aki is a region that is very rich in rainwater, and we can rely on rainwater. The way the greenhouse is designed, the amount of water that we can capture, primarily again through capturing it on the roof, storing it and reusing it. And it's because, again, what we're able to do is measure how much water the plants need, and we don't need to overwater. And I think, you know, one of the challenges of traditional agriculture, and it's why precision agriculture has become such an important trend for sustainability, is, you know, sometimes you don't know, and you don't know in real time the amount of nutrients or water or whatever the plants use. And so the logical thing is just to provide more than you need, and then the excess runs off into the local stream or near where I live, the Chesapeake Bay, which is not a good solution. But you know, that's why we are able to be self-sufficient in terms of rain.
That's interesting. Well, you can also risk washing out all the nutrients. And then there's people like me who have a brown thumb because I'm a city girl and I tend to not water plants enough, but that's another topic. So let's talk about that for a second, though. You mentioned this a couple of times. So AI allows you know, these are novel technologies, right? I mean, agricultural technology, ag tech, is just so fascinating to me on a zillion levels. But talk about how AI actually does this. I mean, how does it, do you pick which crops you're going to grow according to the amount of water and fertilizer they'll need? I mean, how do you pick the, how does the relationship between AI and the crops actually work?
Well, first I would say what we grow is what the market, you know, where market demand is.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's how you run a great business, right? You understand your customer and you want to grow where there's demand. And so, you know, that's where we've, you know, absolutely want to be focused. And we look at that all the time, and we look at data predicting where it may go in the future. You know, I think what we're talking about is, you know, one of the changes we've seen, and we see this in many, many different industries, is how, you know, easy it is to actually go out and get data from sensors. And that just, you know, and large data sets. And so we can feed data in, and it enables us to, you know, continually gather information about the microclimate from these sensors. So what's the humidity, what's the lighting level, then we can adjust in real time to those, you know, to that data stream. We also, you know, use, you know, our roof, which is glass, opens and closes. So there's some ability to control the system through doing that to, you know, help control the humidity. We also, you know, really train our individual crop specialist to be able to go out and, you know, look at what they're scouting for using cameras that travel through the rows. They map the meters. They're looking for picking up real-time alerts of pest and disease risks that then they can feed back to the crop specialist so they can then go look and see what's going on. So all of those are different strategies that really come from the ability to get a lot of measurements very quickly now, very cheaply.
How can you have, I mean, if you're indoors, what, I mean, do you have a pest problem? I saw on your website that you use natural pest management. I interviewed a woman years ago from North Dakota, actually. I think you may recall, I actually lived in North Dakota 10 years ago or 12 years ago. She's funny. She's a farmer in North Dakota, but she didn't want to use chemical pesticides. And so she developed kind of a potpourri that turned into a full-blown business because so many people wanted it to keep for pest management. So are you using something like that? Or, I mean, I would think that being 100% indoors at that and having so much control over the environment, that wouldn't be really an issue.
It's a very low issue. I mean, you know, we'll have sticky traps up in other areas. You know, our goal is to be 100% chemical pesticide free. We have a full-time biological pest specialist who looks at both pests and diseases just to make sure we're, you know, ahead of the issues. You know, it's not, you know, the detailed interactions are not my area of expertise. That's why we've brought him in. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's an area that the closed system provides you incredible advantages to avoiding those problems in the first place.
So you're in Appalachia, which and you said Kentucky, and that area is prone to extreme weather. I mean, they've had hurricanes, they've had tornadoes, and you said it's a very climate resilient property and building. But I mean, if you get a Category 4 hurricane through there, it's tough on buildings. I mean, buildings can be wiped out, roofs can be, you know, blown off, and you know, whatever. How do you know that the building is going to be able to withstand that much, or don't you? Maybe you don't.
You know, I'd have to bring in really our construction expert, my colleague, Chris Scott, to talk about that. I mean, you know, we are designed for very high wind shear. I mean, you know, the data out there, you know, the intent is designed to withstand that. We think that we can withstand, you know, very significant weather. And, you know, the exact wind shear statistic, I don't have off the
That's
top
okay.
of my head. But, you know, it's conversation. I mean, we talk about different aspects of climate resiliency. So, you know, when we have to purchase natural gas to run our boilers, which produces the heat and CO2 into the greenhouses, you know, we make sure that natural gas is dry gas. There's no wet moisture in it, which is the problem they ran into in Texas, is a lot of their gas came from wells. It was wet gas and it froze.
That's interesting. Okay. Well, they also, as I wrote about in Forbes recently, they're victims of groupthink. They had it all, basically everybody there in leadership is a white male, and there were no new ideas at the table. So I did a piece called Women Could Have Prevented the Texas Well, Power and Water Fiasco. Yeah, we can talk about that for about 10 years too, right? You talked a little bit about lighting and opening the roof. Talk about the lighting a little bit, because lighting is really critical in an indoor farm. And I'm trying to picture 60 acres of a green. I mean, that's huge. That is literally almost like putting walls and a tent around an entire farm. It's kind of amazing.
It's and because it's a horizontal site, one of the great advantages in terms of lighting is we get a lot of passive solar. So if you look at this design versus a vertical design, you know, we really are pulling in a lot of passive solar, which of course helps with both lighting and temperature control.
When you open the roof?
No, just when the roof is closed.
Oh, just from the windows, just from through the glass? Oh, okay.
Think of sitting on a beautiful sunroom, right? I mean, the heat you feel when you sit in someone's sunroom. The light you get. So there are some advantages, you know. Now, you know, the yields in our greenhouses are about 30 times a traditional farm.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What's the next thing I was going to ask you about? Because you talked about that, or your website talked about that the yields are ginormous. So talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes. So, you know, so the yields are driven by the ability to, you know, have very high productivity from an acre of land, because you are able to precisely deliver what the plants need. And then we also do bring in supplemental lighting. So we will bring in lighting for some hours of the night if it's a really shady day. And that lighting at our first greenhouse is a mix of 50% LEDs. Bringing in the LEDs is very important, although it's new in the US, but we wanted to integrate that innovation because LED lights are 40% more efficient than the previous generation of high pressure sulfide HPS lights. So we have a mix right now of 50-50 LEDs and HPS, which gives us, you know, already, you know, 20% energy efficiency for our greenhouse, which is a great innovation. And those, you know, those are the lights that we're constantly measuring to make sure that the plants are getting what they need, but not too much. And that really drives photosynthesis. And photosynthesis drives yield. So it's all, you know, a process that then enables us to have the kind of yields that we do.
So there's basically almost no loss, is what you're saying, that the yield is higher because you're using technology to control to get the maximum impact and the least amount of waste, if you will, the least amount of loss.
Yes. I mean, we absolutely want to minimize our losses, and we are new. We planted in October. We started harvesting in January. So, you know, we are.
You're brand spanking new. So you only grow tomatoes now, right? Where are you going to be growing? What else are you going to be growing?
Well, I think that we are looking at an array of different types of tomatoes. So there's tomatoes on the vine, there's beefsteak, there's cherry tomatoes. We know that in our next three greenhouses, one of them is going to be leafy greens. And then we're looking at other things on the market. Greenhouses are, you know, have quite a few different vegetables have been grown in greenhouses, from cucumbers, peppers, strawberries. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll look at all that. And, you know, those are decisions that our product development and our greenhouse development team sit down and really look at all the data and make decisions about what we should be growing where and how to allocate our acreage.
The Donnie Nolan, who I mentioned, I interviewed from George Mason, they use hydroponics and they grow a lot of lettuces, as I recall, lettuces and spices like basil and cilantro and things like that. Your site also says that you're teaching high schoolers and informing agricultural education programs. Tell us a little bit about that and how that works out, how that's done, and maybe who the students are.
So the students are from local high schools. It's a container farm, so that you get the systems of a greenhouse in a microcosm. And it's a great way to teach students about hydroponic farming, what it's about, how, you know, it can really bring together both some of the things they're learning in the classroom, but also thinking about future careers. It gives us a chance to get people interested in this industry. We're going to be hiring a lot of people, so we're excited about that. And it's always great when you can get kids seeing, you know, something in the real world. those programs. I mean, we've enrolled over 1,000 kids in those programs. And we have a great community liaison that, and a, you know, a team that works on the educational program, and we hope to expand it.
I mean, we need more women in this space, right? And we need more on the tech side and on these, you know, in these kinds of roles. And so it would be really good to know more about it. Why is App Harvest a B Corp? I mean, I get that you're providing a benefit, but what's in it for the consumer of buying from a B corporation? Why make a big deal of it? I mean, I must confess, I don't entirely get the whole deal behind B Corp. Every company should do something good for the planet. I don't understand the whole drill. What's in it for the consumer?
So to me, what's really interesting about coming to App Harvest as both a public benefit corporation and a B Corp, and those are two different things. So just to make sure your listeners understand, there has been a very interesting trend in my career. I've watched this with interest, which is enabling companies to file as a public benefit corporation when they file as a corporation. And in that, they articulate goals beyond just optimizing value for shareholders. They articulate goals which speak to other stakeholders, customers, employees, communities. And we did that for App Harvest. Our three goals were to empower individuals in Appalachia, to drive positive environmental change in agriculture, and to improve the lives of our employees and the community in which we operate. So to me, what's really interesting about that is a lot of companies today, whether it's the Business Roundtable or elsewhere, are talking about the importance of companies paying attention to a wider array of stakeholders. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a successful company 5, 10, 15 years from now, that is now recognized as an important part of how you run your business. Filing as a public benefit corporation is standing up and saying, we are serious about that, and we are serious enough that we have filed as a different type of corporation. We are going to report annually on our progress towards that. And we have opted in to having B Labs certify us as a B Corporation. And you go through a rigorous process of answering over 250 different questions about your environmental, social, which is both employees and community, and governance practices, so that you are stress tested on a whole array of environmental, social, and governance issues. I think consumers are just starting to understand what a B Corp means. I think investors are just starting to really appreciate that being able to be successful as a public benefit corporation and a B Corp is the type of company that people want to invest in. And the demand for those types of companies, I think, is going to just get stronger and stronger. So we may be a little bit ahead of the curve on the B Corp in terms of people understanding it, but I think that we are going to continue to have tremendous interest from investors and consumers who really understand increasingly, what does that mean? We're a different type of company.
When I go into the market or even buying things online, but you can, it tells you where something was grown, you know, from Chile, from Mexico, from California, whatever. When somebody buys an App Harvest tomato, first of all, where could they buy it? And because I also saw this thing on autonomous carts carrying the produce to the market, which kind of blew me away. But where can they buy it, and how can they know that it's? I mean, does it say from App Harvest, or does it say from Appalachia or Kentucky, or?
Well, we'll have a little sticker with our logo on it. And we have a partner, Mastronardi, which helps with our distribution, and they'll be distributing to major retailers, you know, in the region. We're within a day's drive of 70% of the U.S. market, so we have lots of opportunities, and you know, we expect to be on the shelves of lots of, you know, major grocers.
You've been in, for lack of a better word, consulting type roles all the times that I've known you, both at EDF and then at Carlyle. Carlyle is not a farm. Carlyle is an office building. And, you know, I mean, so what's it like for you now being in more of an operational role? I mean, you're hands on, you know, you're getting your fingernails dirty, so to speak. You know, well, what's that like for you now?
Yeah. I think what I have really appreciated about my career is that in each phase, I really have learned something very new. And in this operational role, there's no question that now being the one in the hot seat, so to speak, having to drive different sustainability initiatives, having to do all the work that relates to governance, to communicate with all of our key stakeholders, all of that is now coming out of my team. And it's just a great experience to be able to work with the growers in the greenhouse, the construction team, the IT team, and really help integrate sustainability into all those different functions. And I love it. I mean, I love the experience of being on the ground. I love the, you know, work to really bring the science and the financial analysis together, because ultimately I think that's really a big part of sustainability. And then, you know, come up with a strategy that is going to make us a better and better company.
By the way, I forgot to ask you, why Appalachia? You mentioned that it sounds like it's an economic development zone, if you will, but why, you know, there's a lot of other places you could have done this. I mean, what was the paradigm that made I think it's pronounced Appalachia, right? What made Appalachia work? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was where our CEO grew up and a region he's passionate about. And I think there's, you know, any number of advantages there, the rainwater being one, the, you know, ability to build large horizontal greenhouses. It's got, you know, great land resources and it's got just, you know, an amazing workforce there. So I think we're benefiting from all of those. And then of course, geographically, as I mentioned, it's located within a day's drive of 70% of the US population. So if you want resource efficient, locally grown fruits and vegetables, Kentucky's a great place to do it.
No, that's the point. By the way, there's a group I heard about. You may get some workers from the coal industry too, as they get less and less. Yeah, there's a company there, I forget the name of it, that is training coal miners to be coders. And of course, when I heard about that, I thought, well, there's no excuse for me now not learning how to code. So in closing, we like to give advice. And we like to give advice to mid-career women. Say a woman who has maybe 15 years of experience, she's got an understanding of what she does well, maybe what she doesn't do as well, because we all have strengths and not. She's got an education. She wants to use them to make a difference. She's ambitious, wants to make money, you know, wants to advance. What would you tell her? What advice would you give her?
Well, I think one thing is to take chances. And I think some of the most interesting experiences that I have said yes to, I really had no idea how it was going to work out. You know, I didn't overthink it. I kind of, you know, went with the gut of, I just, you know, I like the people or the company or what they were doing. And I would learn a lot. So I think that test for, is this going to stretch me in new ways? And I actually, believe it or not, I have never, the one time in my entire career, I took a job because I thought I should have that kind of a job and it would be good for my resume, was the worst decision I made, and I lasted 6 months. And it's actually not even on my resume anymore.
Well, I had one of those. Mine lasted a year. I mean, I really wanted to work for this company and it was a bleeping train wreck. So. And then, you know, if somebody told me I'd be working in Fargo, North Dakota in the electric car business, I'd look at them like they had 12 heads, right?
Right, right. So I really had, you know, no idea where my career would lead. And when I look back, of course, it looks really logical. Well, of course it wasn't. It was, you know, a series of happenstance. It was different, you know, different things at different times that made sense. A lot of it was driven by personal decisions, maybe, you know, what was happening on the, you know, home front. So I just think being open to new things is really important, and just taking chances.
I agree with that. Did you have kind of a career plan in mind? I mean, you did study chemical engineering and you did study, you know, you obviously got two master's degrees. I got my master's degree as a grown up. I only got mine about 15 years ago or so. But how do you feel about career planning? I mean, how do you feel about figuring out what, because there are some people who, I interviewed a woman recently who did some research on diversity management and career planning. And one of the things that she found in a male dominated industry, and one of the things that she found was that women benefit more from more specific career planning efforts, even if they don't always follow, even if that's not where they end up, but that it's the process of thinking it out and the planning and the figuring out who you need to might need to know and what you might need to know makes a difference.
I mean, I absolutely appreciate that perspective. I think my personal experience was not that way. I will say I had a key mentor at each stage. So, you know, even my first decision to switch into chemical engineering as a major was because I decided environmental issues were really, really cool back in the 80s. And I love science. And it was a great way to kind of combine my interest in science with something very real world. And there was one professor on the campus of Yale who was really working in that space. And he was the one who said, well, if you want to be employable, you should probably major in chemical engineering. And I really had no idea what I was getting myself into. You know, I was a sophomore in college. I was very naive about what chemical engineering was. And so I just said, all right, I'll do it. And, you know, it was a big decision and I didn't second guess it. You know, I just kind of stuck my head down and got through all those engineering classes. And, you know, and I felt like they were a means to the end. There were some, you know, when I was taking my third fluid mechanics class, I can't say I was loving it. You know, I was really loving my art history class more, but, you know, I kept feeling like, okay, sort of a means to an end. And, you know, I think the other thing that I've been lucky about is I've just had backgrounds that were a little bit unique. I tended, and for probably some of the wrong reasons, but, you know, I thought I wanted to be an environmental lawyer. And so I would probably, you know, work at EPA for a couple of years and then go to law school because I didn't know any other way to work in the field. But every time the EPA Region 1 Office of Regional Council had an opening, they had like 300 applicants for it. And I would said, I don't want to compete with that kind of competition, you know, and they were all coming out of probably Harvard Law and other places. And I just decided, well, that just seems too hard. So instead, again, I had a great mentor who said, look, we have a lot of fabulous lawyers, but we don't have a lot of people who like to do project management and people management. So why don't you go look at the Yale School of Management? Why don't you think about developing a skill set that is sort of missing in this field right now? And it was true, like very few people like to do project management. And that turned out to be something I was pretty good at. And that gave me a lot of opportunities. So I think also looking for the white space.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I was going to say, find your own niche, right? Leverage who you are to find your own niche where you're different, right?
Yes. Problem with career paths is they show you how one typically does it. But then you're in the lane with everybody else and sort of competing with everybody else. They don't help you think out of the box about, well, how else could I actually get into this field? What if I love to write? So maybe there's something I should be doing with that. And that's what I think sometimes career coaches, you know, I haven't worked with one, so I don't know how they go about it, but that's what I think you would want to do as you're also thinking about your career.
Well, I happen to do some career coaching and that's not how I approach it at all. So we can talk about that sometime. Yeah, no, I approach it more like you're talking about in terms of, you know, who do you want to be and what parts of you do you want to use?
Yeah.
And what do you know? And, you know, find the Venn diagram, if you will, of all of that with the marketplace. And so it's a more holistic perspective. Oh, yeah, no, you don't. I'm not a follow the crowd kind of girl. So any final thoughts before I let you go, Jackie?
No, I'm glad you're doing this. I love, you know, featuring AppHarvest and women in the field. I think it's an exciting time. I've always believed that solutions to sustainability problems could drive innovation, economic growth, new industries. And that's what is so exciting to me about AppHarvest is that we're doing that. There's real opportunity on the ground. And, you know, that's just a vision. And then it's just been fabulous to take a lot of my experiences and share it with a young team on the ground. My sustainability lead, who's sort of my right-hand person, just graduated 2 years ago from University of Kentucky. My other team member who does recyclable materials for us, he's our recyclable materials coordinator, went to Morehead State University and worked at the Morehead Recycling Center. And then we have a third team member who worked for Fish and Wildlife, who's, you know, helping us think about biodiversity issues on all of our assets part-time. He's also working on greenhouse operations, but you know, it's a very local team that is very talented, and it's fun to bring my experiences to a new area of the country.
I think that's great. And, you know, you're, like you said, you're so centrally located that you can get anywhere pretty easily. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Jackie Roberts from App Harvest. So would you buy produce grown in a giant greenhouse? Does it matter to you where it's grown? Tell us on Twitter at Joan Michelson, and you could win a free coaching session with me. We're doing a new thing where we'll do periodic drawings of responses, and the winner of each drawing will get a complimentary 30-minute coaching session with me. And yes, we tailor to what you need. We are also running a coaching special right now to help you start off the year strong, so please subscribe to our mailing list to get that and stay abreast of our talented, amazing guests like Jackie, our blogs, and more. If you want career advice, or really, if you're struggling in this craziness right now, please reach out to me or somebody, because you're not alone and it's a really stressful time. So take care. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time, and please stay safe.